KPTZ now joins the Board of County Commissioners' weekly meeting for this week's public health updates on COVID-19, live from the Jefferson County Courthouse. This is KPTZ, Port Townsend.
Penalizing individuals. And real quick about the crosswalk, I did speak with Beth last week and with Eric Kuzma. And, you know, we're doing the resurfacing. It's on our consent agenda, even some of it. But we're actively resurfacing Center Road down there by the bank as it goes into Quilting. I think she was hoping initially for a crosswalk at the bus stop, which is against all the manuals and would bring liability on us since
Well, KPTZ waits for the feed to resume, or to get going, actually, for today's briefings on public health and emergency management to our county commissioners. You're tuned to 91.9 FM. Following this broadcast, KPTZ will air Democracy Now!, followed by The Compass and today's Community Resources. This afternoon, by the way, Bryce will be serving up boxed chocolates from 1 to 3, followed by Dr. Dave with Drift Away, so stay tuned.
We can talk about that later, because time is upon us. So with that, we will welcome listeners from KPTZ and also our health officer, Dr. Locke. Looks like he's taking advantage of phase 2 to get his hair cut, and our Department of Emergency Management Director, Willie Benz. So, Dr. Locke, take it away.
Okay, well, thank you. And good morning to everyone. So, I'll start with the national picture, and it's very much a mixed picture. As you look at the states and their degree of COVID-19 control, there are currently, and this was as of this weekend, there were 8 states where you could characterize things as having leveled off, and Washington State is considered one of those. So we're one of the states that have leveled. There's 22 states where things are not leveling off, where the cases are rising faster than the rate of recovery, so there's a net increase in the number of cases, and then there's about 20 cases where things are going as we would like them to go, and that is with declining case levels. And in Washington State, as of this weekend, it's looking like we may be moving out of that leveling off phase into an increasing phase. So there's some very concerning things going on in eastern Washington, and specifically in 4 counties. Yakima, Benton Franklin, and then Spokane counties. And especially Yakima, Benton, and Franklin, things are looking like they were looking in King County in Seattle back in March. So where the rate of growth is not only going up, but it's starting to get into that area that we're most concerned about, where slow, steady growth becomes exponential growth. And that's when it really starts to hit hospitals and you get into surge capacity issues. And that's what those counties are looking at. And really what's driving it there is the agricultural industry, which is just kind of a perfect storm of potential problems with regards to coronavirus transmission, where you have a migratory workforce, where you have living conditions that are often very crowded, sometimes substandard. You have impaired access to health care and optimal sanitation. And in terms of production facilities, the poultry and meat packing plants and some of the the agricultural processing plants. They're designed for people to work in very close proximity. So even though they're making strenuous efforts to try to control things, they appear to be losing ground. So that's a state health officials put out a warning about this over the weekend, and it's you know, something that we're looking at very closely, and we're trying to react to aggressively. Things still are pretty level in Western Washington, and I should note that there seems to be a slight increase in Western Washington, and it's thought to, at least at this point, not have so much to do with the demonstrations that have been occurring, but Memorial Day weekend kind of activities. So people getting out and about. There's a 2 to 3 week lag between events that can increase transmission and when we actually can measure it, and we start to see it showing up in hospitals. So if there's going to be a surge related to the racial justice demonstrations that have been occurring in Washington State and around the country, we really expect this week is when we would start to see that. And we're not sure we will see that. Yeah, there are a number of things that are protective in that the demonstrations occurred outside. In many areas, they were dispersed. A lot of people were wearing masks. Everybody's aware of the coronavirus threat, so people were trying to take precautions. But there were also things going on that increased transmission risk. You know, people being a demonstration, people were shouting and speaking loudly and were in close proximity to each other at times. And we think that things like tear gas are especially bad with coronavirus. Anything that would cause a person to cough and have respiratory distress is just the exact opposite of what you would want if your goal was to prevent transmission. And people being locked up in holding cells after they're arrested is also a risk factor. So we're definitely watching that. One of the questions I received from the KPTZ audience is that they had been to the Seattle March. They were wearing a mask. They were social distancing. Should they be tested? And my response to that is that we're not recommending a blanket testing for everyone who's been to demonstrations. And mostly that has to do with the fact that the test isn't that good at ruling out infection in people who don't have symptoms. And we just don't know if it's valuable in that setting. The people I would definitely recommend that get tested, if you're coming back from a public demonstration and then going back to work in with a high-risk population, say you work in a skilled nursing facility or you're the caretaker for an elderly parent or other person or someone in your household is a high-risk individual and you're a caretaker or in close contact, then the risks or the stakes go up substantially, and that, in my view, would justify testing. And you want to wait about a week after exposure. So I wouldn't recommend immediate testing because that's even less likely to show a problem if it, in fact, occurs. But we think that at this point, 7 days is about right. You know, if you become infected and if the test can pick it up, it should be positive by that time. You know, if people are concerned about this and they want us to sort of review their risks for them, if they have been especially involved in the Seattle area demonstrations, then you know, we can go over that with them. But that's something we don't know at this point, whether that's going to significantly drive activity. One thing we are very much concerned about, and this is not just in Washington State, but all over the country, as things open up and people are getting outdoors and going back to restaurants, and they have more and more options for social engagement, there appear to be a lot of people who have not gotten the memo about masking and physical distancing, to no great surprise, a lot of them appear to be adolescents and young people, which is, by its nature, this is a high risk-taking period in life. But this is not the direction we need to be going in now in terms of this pandemic. We need to be doing the exact opposite, and more people have to be taking it seriously if we're able to sustain these openings, we have strong evidence, I'll go over this in a moment, that these are going to be key factors, and really the sustainability of the reopening efforts that we're trying to undertake are going to depend not on what healthcare professionals or public health professionals can do, but whether the public does the critical part in controlling transmission. So before though I get into that, I want to just complete the Washington State, we're starting to see some concerning trends in Jefferson County. Activity has been very low, actually. We did get a new case this weekend, so we're now up to 31 confirmed cases. We just started the investigation of this yesterday, and so there's still some unanswered questions, but certainly does appear that the transmission occurred within the county, but there might be some multi-state links involved. And so there are going to be, it's looking at this point, a lot of contacts, a number of potential sources. So that's what contact tracing is all about, is to identify all of them, get everyone tested who needs to be tested, and everyone who needs to be quarantined, get them into quarantine. And nowadays we do that almost immediately, you know, within hours or less of getting the test results. That's our first priority. And then sort of epidemiologically investigating the whole situation and putting the pieces together and trying to reconstruct how the transmission occurred, with the goal of identifying other people that we may be able to notify and other infections we may be able to prevent, that takes more time. So that's where we are with that at this point. Two new studies have come out in this last week that I think have strong bearing on where we're going in these control efforts. One in the Annals of Internal Medicine was a big, you know, what we call a review article, where it tries to pull together a bunch of different studies and analyze them in respect to each other and sort of draw conclusions from the analysis of a bunch of different studies as opposed to one at a time. And this one was looking at asymptomatic transmission. So it pulled together the 16 big international studies of asymptomatic transmission and came to the conclusions that, you know, not only is this a factor, but a very significant one. The current estimate now is between 40 and 45% of transmission of COVID-19 is people who have no idea that they're carrying it, they do not feel sick. And so they're truly asymptomatic. And then we also think another group who so-called pre-symptomatic, so people who eventually will get symptoms, but they don't at the time they're transmitting it, that's a significant group as well. So there's more and more consensus that asymptomatic transition not only occurs, but it's a very significant pathway, and very likely by an airborne route. So these what are known as respiratory aerosols, the fine mists that we generate when we're speaking or shouting or singing, these things suspend virus in the air. And then people who are in close proximity can breathe this in or otherwise be exposed to it. So that more and more as we're looking at the pathway for how what have become known as super spreader events. So people who don't know that they're infected, who manage to infect dozens of other people. That's how it seems to be working. It's not as if every person with coronavirus infection creates two more cases, and that's it. It's in fact that the way it's seeming to work is that some people who have it don't spread it to anyone else. Other people who have it spread it to a lot of different people. So the infectivity is highly variable and highly unpredictable among people who have the infection. And then that brings us to the other big study that came out. And this was the World Health Organization had been expected to come out with a position on masking because they had sort of been the holdout, as it were, in international organizations that were strongly promoting masking in public. Many people who have written in to me to express their displeasure with the masking directive have cited the World Health Organization's lack of support for this. Now that's past history. Their new study strongly comes out in favor of masking. They review the literature on this up to this point and conclude that what it is most useful for is as a source control strategy. So if people wear masks, it traps these aerosols and droplets that we generate when we cough or sneeze or just speak. And that so if everyone assumed that they were infected, whether they had symptoms or not, and wore a mask in any situation where they could transmit that infection to someone else, we would see dramatic decreases in transmission. That was essentially their conclusion. And masks do have some protective benefit, too, and it depends a lot on the mask construction. You know, we know the highest grade medical masks, the N95 masks, are highly protective. Surgical masks, which are becoming more and more available, are somewhere in between. And then cloth masks, at least in some of the official studies of them, are the least protective. But even then, you know, they offer filtration in the 10 to 20% range, and that can be increased with different materials. So there's a lot out there. People can kind of pick and choose. They can pick masks that are mostly for source control and droplet transmission. These masks are very often quite comfortable. They're soft cotton. They're very breathable. Or you can pick more masks with higher filtration. But from a public health standpoint, we're really looking at this as a source control strategy. And that's a difficult idea for people to get their heads around, because people are used to looking at masks as somewhat something that benefits the person wearing it. And whereas that's true, and as I say, you know, varies how much protection you get varies by the type of mask, what you're really doing in terms of disease transmission is protecting others. So that's part of the challenge of this, is just motivating people to do something primarily for the benefit of others. And it's why it's so important in indoor settings that we have very high levels of compliance, of participation in masking. So those kind of putting those two studies together, we have the sort of the traditional communicable disease control imperatives where household members, close contacts, the sort of the traditional people that we know are most at risk for infection. And that's something we can really get at with our case investigation and contact tracing. But the other challenge of this is going to be the asymptomatic transmission out in public, where we're never going to know who those contacts are, because the person with the infection doesn't know those people. They're just random members of the public. So we need to really control this, and especially as we open up, we need to get that under control. And I don't see, and I don't know anyone else who sees an alternative to the very basic but also highly effective twin strategies of physical distancing and masking in virtually all indoor settings, and those outdoor settings where you can't maintain that 6 foot or greater separation at all times. So I just, only other thing I'd report on is phase three is increasing around the state. That is, more and more counties are moving towards submitting phase three application. So far, it's mostly been the small counties in eastern Washington. Actually, some of the smallest in the state are the ones that have gone first. But now this week, it's going to be moving into larger counties are at least becoming eligible for phase three. And the reports I'm getting are most are moving forward with those applications. And as I tried to outline in my memo on this to the Board of Health, whereas I'm recommending this for Jefferson County, that we move ahead with phase three, it's not without risks. It's significant risk. And the risk gets, as disease rates go up around the state, and especially in Washington, and the summer progresses, and we see more and more travelers moving throughout the state, all of those are risk factors. And all of them make it more important for us to do all these protective and disease-controlling things that we know how to do. It's kind of one of the reasons I'm recommending going forward is I don't see this as getting better. I don't see the risk or the challenge getting any less over the course of the summer. That, in fact, this is probably where we are right now is about as good as it's going to get. And in fact, so we're expecting to see more transmission in Jefferson County. We're going to be challenged to control it. But that's what we've been training for in public health and the healthcare setting. Again, to emphasize the part that we can't do is the prevention part of it. That's where the public comes in, and that's why the public ownership of this, the public participation in this, is going to be the make it or break it phenomenon. And that's not to push the responsibility on others. That's just the reality of this. Anyone who thinks that they can sort of sit out the coronavirus pandemic on the sidelines and just wait for other people to control it for them, they're mistaken. This is going to depend on every single person identifying what they can do to prevent transmission and then doing that. And if we do that, if we get to that very high level of participation, there's a lot of reasons to believe we can be successful. There are countries all over the world that are doing an extraordinary job of controlling this pandemic by applying these kind of control strategies. It's just, unfortunately, the United States is not one of these countries at this time. We are not doing what we need to do, what we know we need to do, and we're suffering the consequences of it. We're trying to take a different route here in Washington State, but we're not an island nation. And so we, what goes on all around us has an effect. And unfortunately, of those 20 states where things are going up rather than down, two of them are neighbors here on the West Coast. So Oregon and California are both states where things are going up. So I just wanted to conclude. I wanted to quickly check and see if there's any KPTZ questions that I didn't answer. I heard Commissioner Brotherton answer the, you know, if you walk into a business and they're not wearing masks, leave is my answer too. Don't put yourself at risk. You know, remember that those unmasked people, you know, that they're also people, if they happen to be asymptomatically carrying the infection, they could be spreading it within that environment. And your mask, the mask you are wearing, will give you some protection against that, but not complete protection. I qualify that answer. We're not asking anyone to be the mask police. When you see someone who's not wearing a mask, you never really know what their story is. They may have a medical reason that they can't wear a mask, or they may not. You just don't know that, and so it's best not to judge them. I would look out for your own health and leave that spot. And I think it would be valuable to tell the manager, probably not right at the, I wouldn't seek out the manager because that would mean staying in that place, but call or email them and let them know that you do not feel comfortable patronizing their business, you know, until they make more of an effort to make it safer.
Can you speak a little bit to the question about L&I and state enforcement of state guidelines, the distinction between county guidelines?
Absolutely. So in terms of the mandate for employers and employees of all businesses to wear masks, that is not a suggestion from the state. That is a labor and industry mandate financial penalties and other sanctions attached to it. So that is a requirement because employers are required to protect the health of their employees. That's the basis behind that. So any business that does not enforce that masking mandate within their workers is essentially failing to do something they could do to protect those workers.
Just to add one more point. As a customer going in, though, I don't know if one particular employee has a medical exemption that means they can't wear the mask.
Right. And that's really hard to know. And often in most cases, those individuals use some sort of alternative, like a face shield. And a face shield is not, it actually makes sense for someone who has a medical exemption or someone who needs visibility of face structures for for communication. So as with someone who requires lip reading for communication, there you either need to use a face mask or there are masks that have now been developed that have clear panels in them that, that allow you to see a person's lips. For people who can wear face masks, a face covering, a cloth mask is really the only effective thing for source control. A face shield does not provide source control. It does not trap the secretions. It does provide some protection to the wearer of the shield, especially it prevents droplets from getting in the eyes. It may reduce the risk of if someone coughs right in front of you, some of those ejected droplets will be intercepted by the face shield. But face shields and face masks are not interchangeable. Under the labor and industry guidelines, people who can't wear face masks are allowed to wear face shields in certain situations. And just to complete that question, the county health officer directive, it's a directive, but it's not one that we're associating punishment, monetary penalties, criminal sanctions, anything of that sort. At this point, most of the directives around the state are not starting off with punitive enforcement. We don't really think this is the kind of thing that we can punish people into complying with. We don't want to do that. And I want to emphasize to people that this is a really long road that we're embarking down. We're going to be doing this for a year or longer. We have some time to learn a different way of functioning in public. And some people learn faster than others. And I hope that more and more people get it. They get look at the evidence. They consider what it's going to take to be successful at this. They deal with their opposition to it. This notion of making masks a part of or not wearing masks a partisan statement. A sort of a reflection of your political ideology. This is the thing that makes communicable disease specialists crazy, because it should have nothing to do with that. This is about a virus that does not care about your ideology, and so it's really the only valid question should be: does it work or does it not work, and who should use it and how should you use it?
I would add, Dr. Locke, it's not an individual choice. It's our responsibility. Do we have the right to put other people at risk by not complying? And I would not.
Yeah, that's exactly it. That's how you need to look at it, is this is not a choice that only affects your welfare. This is a choice that affects other people. You could be carrying this virus without knowing it. You could be spreading it to another person without knowing it. And that other person could become seriously ill or die as a result of that. So the stakes couldn't be higher.
Dr. Locke and also Commissioner Brotherton, can you speak to the any further information on the potential timing for moving to phase 3?
Go ahead, Dr. Locke.
Well, my part of it, the health officer recommendation has been made a much shorter, simpler form of that will be presented to the Board of Health this Thursday. So the Board of Health gets to take up the question on Thursday, June 18th, at their 2:30 to 4:30 meeting. And although they're not obligated to, they have the option of making that decision. They have a draft resolution to that effect was distributed to the board. And then the final step, at least in terms of approval, is with the county commissioners. And then we're working this week in the health department on the application. So we also have to meet all the different metrics and criteria for eligibility. And I haven't seen the final data on that. My guess is we do. We certainly do in terms of case counts. We're looking at things like testing data, whether we're at the adequate thresholds of that. But I'm not really seeing a barrier in terms of the metrics. So I haven't heard if the commissioners, if you have scheduled a Friday meeting, or if it would be the next Monday. But that would influence the timeline as well. And then it's we're being told by the state that the review process could be 2 or 3 days. It's not the one-day turnaround that we saw with phase two.
And I can speak a little more to that. I know we've been really trying to adopt a regional approach, and I have talked to the chairs of Kitsap County, DOCC, and Clallam County. And the current expectation is that their health officer in Clallam County will give a go-ahead to phase three and camping, maybe, at tomorrow's Board of Health meeting for probable application on the 18th when I think they qualify. And I've heard that Kitsap County has, I think, a normal Board of Health meeting on the 18th. They were hoping to do it earlier, but had a few cases that gave them pause, so they hope to apply on the 19th, is what I heard.
I heard the same timeline with Kitsap County. I did receive a note from Dr. Unthank in Clallam County expressing some concerns about the increased case activity in Western Washington and also in Clallam County. So I'm not sure if her recommendation is going to be to go forward at this time, this week, on phase three. I have been told that yes, they are going to consider camping, certainly tomorrow. But I'm not sure. Maybe the decision hasn't been made yet on phase three.
Yeah, Dr. Locke and Commissioner Brotherton, the last I heard last week is that Dr. Unthank was perhaps thinking of waiting until the 22nd. Greg, what further discussion have you had?
You know, not with Dr. Unthank. I mean, you know, I failed to connect with the chair of Clallam County DOCC, and he sent me a text this morning saying he expected a full recommendation tomorrow at the Board of Health meeting. So,
okay.
You know, Dr. Locke's intel is from a more direct source on the person that would actually make the recommendation. So, you know, I think we're in the ballpark of the same day, but, you know, as we found out going to phase two, it's hard to coordinate exactly because we do all of our own work to do. All right, I'm conscious that we're holding up Mona and Drew from DNR, but let's get some quick questions. Go ahead, David.
We can't hear you, David. You may want to turn off your camera so we can hear your audio.
Or you can pantomime it if you're going to trade. Not great for the KPTV listeners.
This happens about 5 months, 1 week, when you saw. Okay. But it doesn't have the 1 week interval or 1 per week interval. Can we be more clear about that?
You were pretty garbled at the beginning of your question. Can you restate the beginning of it, Davis?
Okay. In phase two, it says what gatherings are up to 5 people 1 time per week. In phase three, it says up to 50 people, but it doesn't say how many times per week. I think we need to be more clear.
That is unclear under phase three. I'm reading it as 50 people at a time and without a per week restriction. That's kind of the unless there's some clarifying guidance to that, and there might not be, because this is really a public gathering thing as opposed to a business. I can pose that question though to the state, just to make sure that is in fact the reading of it, that when we move from phase two to phase three, we're moving away from that sort of per week budget, as it were, for how many other households we can encounter.
A couple of quick questions. One, has the World Health Organization actually changed their recommendation at this point? And then secondly, I've heard of folks who did attend protests in Seattle and were wanting to get tested here and did not meet the testing threshold. Do you know if that is still the case? If that plans to change, how should folks proceed if they have that concern?
So first of all, my understanding is, yes, the World Health Organization did change their position and now endorses masking as a source control strategy, and points to the countries, the most successful countries at controlling this, Taiwan and South Korea, several others, Japan, use masking very extensively. So they think that is one of the factors creating that success. And then in terms of my current recommendation, people who have been to demonstrations and who have symptoms should absolutely be tested. And if that's not happening, let us know and we'll help facilitate that for them. We don't recommend blanket testing for everyone who's been there. At least from what we know now, the risk is not that high. But as I said, I would make an exception. If you're given the fact that these infections can be asymptomatic, if you're in a situation where you're in close contact with a high-risk individual, that kind of tips the balance to testing you, even if you're asymptomatic.
Okay, thank you.
Go ahead, David.
Is there guidance on going backwards from phase three to back to phase two if things are getting worse?
That's a great question. I don't really see that's not addressed extensively in the plan. I've heard the governor comment on that is an option, certainly, is to go backwards. It would be an option at a local level too. We can't do things less stringent than the state, but we can do things certainly more stringent. In fact, I would. If I thought there was an outbreak occurring in conjunction with a restaurant or another business, the responsible thing to do as a health officer would be to close that business for 2 to 3 weeks until the outbreak had been brought under control. So we have that option. And at a state level, several state governors, New Jersey, New York, have talked about moving backwards and reimposing lockdowns if things don't come under control and people don't take the masking and physical distancing seriously. So I think although it's not extensively, it's not discussed in the plan, I think that's how it would play out, is it goes both ways. And we have to, if we're starting to lose control of transmission, we have to step back and do things differently. Because what we can't do is get into that exponential growth phase, because that's where you really lose control and you overrun your healthcare system's ability to take care of the sick people.
Yeah. Well, do encourage people to vote to open with wearing a mask.
Great. All right. And thank you for your patience, Mona and Drew. We'll be done here real quick. If there's no more pressing questions for Dr. Locke, we'll pass it off to Willie Vince for his DEM update.
Thank you, Commissioner. I will keep this quick, and I will focus almost exclusively on masks, since that's been a big touch point for this briefing thus far. First, our community mask program is going to have a couple of changes this week. As the libraries start to come online, they need their drop boxes back, which is what we've been using for folks to come in and donate their homemade sewn cloth masks. So we still want to urge folks to donate masks so that folks who don't have masks can come in and pick them up. Because we've had about a little over 5,000 masks that have been locally made, donated, and then distributed thus far. So we're going to continue to distribute masks at local grocery stores, all the other places listed on our website, but we're going to have to make a few tweaks to the donation areas. So you can still donate them through DEM. Contact us. You can drop them off directly with us. We're talking with Public Health about making their offices a drop point as well. You can still drop them off at the co-op. So there are still ways to donate if you still want to donate cloth masks for use, because we started experiencing a little bit of a lull in donations, but once the masking order came online, we saw a lot more demand, a lot more being produced, and we still have a great need for masks. So get in contact with us if you want to donate or if you need a mask and don't have any yet. We also have about 18,000 additional masks coming into the county via the State Emergency Operations Center. Those are from an order from Governor Inslee, who wants two masks for all Washingtonians who are at 200% or below of the poverty line in the state, so for all low-income Washingtonians. That's about 1.8 million across the state and 9,000 here locally in Jefferson County. So we'll be getting 18,000 here. Within the next 2 to 4 weeks, we're submitting our plan to the state EOC for distribution of those this week. They'll be going to all the local food banks, service organizations, pretty much anywhere that has a touch point with the low-income community here in Washington, or here in Jefferson County. So that plan will be released a little bit later this week, and we're hoping to get those masks in, again, the next 2 weeks, maybe as much as a month. So if you need a mask more urgently, do get in contact with us. But again, we'll be having a huge influx of masks available here within the month. Lastly, through a grant from the Jefferson Community Foundation, our mask-making group did purchase 4,000 masks. A couple hundred of those went to service organizations, again, for more urgent needs, not wanting to wait on the state masks to get here. And then 3,700 went to the Chamber of Commerce for distribution to those businesses who sign up for the JeffCo Care Pledge to then make available to customers who may walk in and not be wearing a mask. So there are about 100 businesses, a little over 100 businesses that have signed up for that pledge thus far. They're being offered packs of those cloth masks, again, to make available. So as we talked about, encouraging folks to go to those businesses who sign up for the pledge, committing to the safety of their customers. Know that if you go to one of those businesses and you don't have a mask, or you see someone who's walking in who doesn't have a mask, one will potentially be made available to those folks. So just another way to try to encourage stronger masking indoors. And then, again, I think I said a couple of weeks ago, I really want not having a mask to not be an excuse. So between the community masking program, the masks we purchased for the grant, and then now the 18,000 masks coming in from the state EOC, that's about 30,000 that have been pushed in through this community masking program and through other sources. And that's not counting the ones that folks are buying on an individual basis. I've mentioned, you know, places like Amazon, a lot of, you know, bands and TV shows and, you know, popular culture type stuff, they're making masks with their logos or, you know, some other nonsense on them that you can buy. So that's not counting the ones bought individually or made themselves. So we're getting a ton of masks into the county, and people are using them, which has been really encouraging. A couple of our volunteers have done some informal surveys of mask usage. They noted that before Dr. Locke's masking order, they were seeing about 60% mask usage in grocery stores. And this is unscientific. Don't take this as the gospel or anything. But this was an informal survey, a little over half. Once the masking order was put into place, they saw that jump up to about 80%. And then just recently, they're seeing about 90%. So just about everyone in these grocery stores, they're seeing wearing a mask. Some other retail outlets, not quite as good. They're hovering in the 60%, a little over half. And they noted on outside, you know, down on Water Street in downtown PT, that's about 20%. But again, that's outside, less of a risk factor. So we really want to see that more indoors. So it is improving. Again, we're still continuing to push masks in there, into the community. So yeah, just want to, as we've been encouraging folks to, you know, get a mask if you don't have one, and then wear it. It's not that hard. It's not that difficult. It's not a political point to not wear one. It's protecting other people. So we'll continue to encourage that. The only other thing I will update for the group, we got some good news from FEMA. We initially thought the end of June was going to be the deadline for FEMA reimbursement claims for Stafford Act money. That was just kind of a default 60-day period for a presidential declaration. This is obviously an ongoing disaster response and relief effort. So that means we'll be able to continue to work with FEMA for reimbursement for certain eligible response costs. This being a pandemic and not a more kind of, quote, traditional disaster like a, you know, an earthquake or a wildfire or a hurricane, those reimbursable costs are a lot more limited. But that means our finance section can continue to work with the city, the county, other eligible jurisdictions to get some money back. As we've been spending a lot of time and effort and money responding to this emergency, that helps offset some of those costs. So some good news there. We're continuing to put in projects, and we'll hopefully start seeing some of that money back into the community soon. So the only other thing I'll mention, I forgot to mention it during my masking briefing, the question from the KPTV listeners, Dr. Locke mentioned them earlier, the masks with the little clear window for folks who do use nonverbal lip reading communications. I do believe those are going to be part of the order from the state EOC that we'll be getting in the next 2 to 4 weeks. I'm not sure on exact quantities, but I'll be sure to follow up and share some more information on next week's briefing for that. But I believe we will indeed be getting some of those and distributing those to folks who need them. That's the end of my report. If there are any questions.
Great. Thank you very much, Willie. Great news about FEMA and good movement on the masking, too. So thanks for your effort. Go ahead, David.
Can't hear you. We can't hear you. Still can't hear you.
I would just point out that lip readers need other people to have those masks. They literally need other people to have those masks. They need other people to have the mask.
Yeah, but maybe a family that, you know, I mean, can only do what we can do. You know, you can't order everyone else around you to wear a mask like that.
And the purpose is for, friends, family, potentially coworkers, those in kind of close, in need of close contact and coordination. So, yeah, understood. Thank you.
Any other questions for Willie? Okay. Well, thank you to Dr. Locke and Willie Bench for your continued work, and we will see you next Monday here. And thank you for to listeners of KPTZ as well as the video listeners from the old Jefferson County. So we'll let you go, Dr. Locke and Willie, and we'll talk to you next week. So we'll probably see you Thursday for at that Board of Health meeting too to talk about Phase 3 some more. Thank you very much.
Commissioners, just a reminder that you haven't taken action yet on the consent agenda.
This is KPTZ Port Townsend. We've just heard the weekly public health updates on COVID-19 live from the Jefferson County Board of County Commissioners meeting at the courthouse. Again, thanks for listening.